This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the August 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. As I mentioned to you 2 weeks ago, this will be the last time you'll be hearing Takes on the World at this time. According to KZOX's new schedule goes into effect September 3rd, Takes on the World on Joy LeClaire's Forthright Radio will be coming to you from 11 a.m. to noon. You can check out the entire new schedule by going to kzyx.org. If you have any comments or questions about the schedule changes, you can call the station at 707-895-2324, the listener comment line at 707-895-9619, or email program director Alice Wolfel at pd@kzyx.org. And now on to today's program. It has been our good fortune as Americans, but a pity for the rest of the world, that we have not experienced a war on our soil since the middle of the 19th century. Thanks to our unrivaled military and economic power, this has allowed our government to fire missiles and drop deadly bombs on peoples across the globe who have never harmed or threatened us, as casually and with as little reflection as an earlier generation of Americans tossed empty beer cans to the side of our country roads. We have been taught in our public schools one of the biggest whoppers ever told. That has been reinforced by whoever has inhabited the White House, that the U.S. serves as a beacon of freedom for the rest of the world. Even the most cursory examination of our history reveals that to be a myth. Of course, our history is more than that, but it might be argued President Donald Trump is a better representative of its sordid side than anyone who has ever held that office. Sunday was the 65th anniversary of a U.S.-backed coup in Iran, which removed from power its democratically elected president, Mohammad Mossadegh, and installed in his place a brutal dictator, Reza Pahlavi, as its Shah, who ruled with Washington's support for 26 years until overthrown by a popular uprising in 1979. It's something Americans don't know and, if told, would prefer not to think twice about. Nor are they apparently giving much thought to Washington's plans to replace the government in Tehran that overthrew the Shah, which has been moving apace without the attention the subject merits by a press absorbed with Russiagate and presidential tweets. Much like the war in Saddam Hussein's Iraq was preceded with years of crippling sanctions, the Trump administration escalating sanctions against Tehran that had largely been lifted following Iran's signing of an agreement with the U.S. and its fellow members in the U.S. Security Council, plus Germany, to downsize and freeze its nuclear enrichment program. As he had promised during his campaign in 2016, President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the agreement in July, placing his future in jeopardy and elevating the possibility of another devastating U.S. war in the Middle East. As with that withdrawal, as Trump promised, came the renewal of U.S. sanctions against a number of industries and products earlier this month, with more targeting Iran's vital oil sales scheduled for early November. To make them effective, the U.S. has also threatened to enforce secondary sanctions against any country or company that has the temerity to ignore Washington's wishes and continues to do business with Tehran. This was standard U.S. policy well before Trump, and it includes America's allies. To discuss Washington's war of sanctions against Iran and examine their implications, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with Tyler Cullis, a Washington-based attorney who specializes in international sanctions. So stay tuned for that. Well, last week, the Trump administration announced the appointment of a special envoy, an extreme hawk named Brian Hook, to coordinate the economic pressure campaign against Iran, purportedly to get it to sign a new nuclear agreement that would be more agreeable to Washington. The White House's real intent, however, revealed by other statements coming out of the White House and the pro-Israel think tanks and lobbying organizations that have been the primary backers of the sanctions and regime change, is to curtail Iran's development of a defensive missile system and cause it to terminate all its operations outside of its own borders. As Hook himself put it after his appointment was announced, quote, "Now we can go after the Iranian regime to deny them what they need to support Assad, the Houthis, and Iran's militia and proxies," end quote, referring to the Yemenis battling the U.S.-backed Saudis and United Arab Emirates in their home country, and to Hezbollah and other Shia from the region who have been fighting on behalf of the government in Syria. Hook's reference to the Houthis in Yemen made it clear the U.S. expects no steps to be taken by any country to curtail Washington's supplying the Saudis and the UAE with weapons, with mid-air jet refueling and targeting intelligence, as America's contribution to the worst humanitarian disaster on the planet, which human rights activist Kathy Kelly discussed on my last program. In introducing Hook to the media, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo enthusiastically noted, "We have the right strategy and an Iran-focused A-team already here at stake. We urgently need to accelerate our diplomacy and coordination with partners around the globe," he added, not mentioning at the moment those in agreement with U.S. policy on Iran consists of Israel, the Saudis, and United Arab Emirates, with all of America's European allies firmly against it. "That has never mattered to such pro-Israel operations such as the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, spawned by AIPAC in 1985, which has been pushing toward confronting Iran since before the Gulf War, even if it takes a false flag attack to start it." Here, for a little more than a minute, listen to an excerpt from the comments of the Washington Institute's Patrick Clawson, How to Handle Iran, from the question period following a talk of his in September of 2012.
Compromise is not company. That the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II. As David mentioned, you may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall he had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We can do a variety of things if we wish to increase the pressure. I'm not advocating that, but I'm just suggesting that this is not a either-or proposition of, you know, it's just sanctions has to succeed or other things. We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. We could get nastier at that.
Patrick Clawson of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a major pro-Israel think tank on Capitol Hill. While not in the State Department, the most important player in the White House's anti-Iran team is probably John Bolton, who before his appointment as National Security Advisor advocated both regime change in Tehran as well as dropping the bombs on Iran to bring it about. Even the mainstream media acknowledged that Bolton's getting the job was the result of pressure put on Trump by his major benefactor, Las Vegas multi-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, to get rid of H.R. McMaster and replace him with someone more favorable to Israel, namely Bolton. Perhaps Bolton's greatest compliment in that regard came when he was serving as George W. Bush's U.N. ambassador, and Dan Gilliman, who held the same post for Israel, praised Bolton as having been, quote, the sixth man in our office. Let's not forget that Bolton could not get Senate approval for his appointment as U.N.'s ambassador because of his hawkishness and only got the job through a recess appointment by Bush when Congress was not in session. On Monday, Bolton arrived in Israel where Jerusalem Post reported, quote, he received an especially warm welcome from Israeli President Reuven Rivlin. Rivlin's always happy to welcome visitors, he said, but in Bolton's case, the paper reported, it was also with the knowledge that Bolton is, quote, a great friend of the State of Israel and the Jewish people, end quote. Rivlin told Bolton how much he appreciated all that he has done to date for Israel, and, quote, we know what you're going to do, but you're going to do more, which might be read ominously given Bolton's plans for Iran. Rivlin's praise was not mere lip service, noted the Jerusalem Post article. Bolton was in Jerusalem in July a year ago to receive the Guardian of Zion Award from Bar-Ilan University's Ingeborg Rennert Center for Jerusalem Studies for fostering relations between the U.S. and Israel. He has been a featured speaker at the annual Herzliya Conference, which is considered Israel's center stage for the discussion of the country's policies by its most prominent figures, including the president, the prime minister, and the chief of the Army's general staff. After meeting with Rivlin, the Times of Israel reported Bolton moved on to the office of Israel's defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, a one-time Moldavian beer hall bouncer, which I suspect was the more important of the two meetings. We have a very important supportive president in the White House and a very supportive administration. This gives us significant maneuvering room vis-a-vis our enemies to the north and south, Lieberman's office quoted him as saying. Please note Lieberman's use of the possessive pronoun we when referring to Trump. It was not an accident. While some in the U.S. might object to the characterization of Washington as Israeli-occupied territory, even as most important occupied territory, the control of U.S. policy when it comes to Israel is taken for granted in Israel. There have been numerous examples of that in the Israeli media, but none more explicit than when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was unknowingly recorded in a video released to the Israeli media speaking in Hebrew in 2001 to a group of Israelis in which he bragged, quote, I know what America is. America is a thing you can move very easily, move in the right direction. They won't get in the way, end quote. Curiously enough, while Netanyahu's comments were reprinted on several blogs, including that of the Washington Post leading political writer Glenn Kessler, as well as on Huffington Post and the Daily Kos, Kessler did not write about it for the Post print edition, and likewise, it wasn't seen as fit to print in the New York Times or any other American newspaper. That's evidence, I would suggest, that the U.S. media is also something that Israel has been able to move around very easily. This has been clearly the woman's year thus far in the election primaries, but the issue of Israel has nevertheless made its way into the picture and not surprisingly has muddled it. The first candidate to stumble was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who upset one of the most influential House Democrats, Joe Crowley, in the New York primary in June, and then was forced to explain critical comments she had made earlier about Israel's killing and wounding of Palestinians during largely peaceful protests in Gaza. In a May Twitter message, she wrote that the Israeli army had committed, quote, a massacre, unquote, in Gaza. No state or entity is observed mass shootings of protesters. There is no justification, she wrote. Palestinian people deserve basic human dignity as anyone else. Democrats can't be silent about this anymore, unquote. When asked about it, that in a post-election interview, she said, quote, I think I was primarily compelled to speak out on moral grounds because I could only imagine if 60 people were shot and killed in Ferguson, or if 60 people were shot and killed in the West Virginia teacher strikes. The idea that we're not supposed to talk about people dying when they're engaging in political expression just really moved me, end quote. However, when the issue came up in an interview on PBS's Firing Line, she had trouble explaining her position clearly, and she since has been subject to attacks for her stance on other issues such as single-payer health care and free college tuition. But she is certain to be elected since, as the New York Post pointed out, there's only one person standing between her and Washington, a Queens Republican who hasn't even filed the paperwork needed to raise campaign funds. Then on August 7th, Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American Muslim, won the primary in Michigan's 13th congressional district in a bid to replace the longtime office holder John Conyers, who is pressured to retire following allegations of sexual harassment. Unlike Ocasio-Cortez, who had no prior experience in public office, Tlaib, whose parents were born and emigrated from the Palestinian West Bank, was a seasoned member of the Michigan State Legislature and had won the endorsement and a $3,000 contribution from J Street, a light beer version of AIPAC, on the basis of what J Street said was their support for a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict and continuation of U.S. aid to Israel. This immediately led to the questioning of Tlaib by activists within the Palestinian-American community and to her backing down from what J Street claimed was her support for the two-state solution and U.S. aid to Israel. This resulted in J Street withdrawing his endorsement. While commending Tlaib for her history of fighting for social justice, J Street's statement explained that it was compelled to do so since support for a two-state solution, which was never more than a fantasy, is a prerequisite for its backing of any candidate. J Street's decision, however, will have no effect on the November election, however, since this largely African-American district is so heavily Democratic that no one bothered to run the Republican primary. Then last week, the third candidate, whose position on Israel and Palestine became an issue, Somali-American Minnesota State Legislature Ilhan Omar, won the primary for a seat vacated by fellow Muslim Keith Ellison, who resigned from Congress to run for the office of the state's attorney general. Omar drew national attention just 2 years ago by becoming the first Somali-American elected to a state legislature, and if she wins in November in what is described as a reliably liberal district, she would be the first Somali-American elected to Congress. It turned out, however, that Omar previously attacked Israel as being an apartheid regime in a tweet attack in 2012 and accused it of quote-unquote evil doings. She has since learned that those opinions will not fly politically in the Democratic Party, and she has since spoken with Jewish community leaders and declared her support for Israel's right to exist and her opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel. And so it goes. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.